Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Valeria Luiselli. Valeria is an acclaimed author of both nonfiction and fiction. She's written the novels Faces in the Crowd, The Story of My Teeth, and most recently, Tell Me How It Ends, an essay in 40 questions. She's been the winner of an American Book Award. She's been a National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 honoree. Her work has appeared in McSweeney's, which I love, The New York Times, Granta, which I love, as well as many other publications. Her latest work, the one we'll be discussing today, is Lost Children Archive, published earlier this month by Knopf. Lost Children Archive documents a cross-country trip that is goal-oriented for both a husband and wife whose marriage is disintegrating. Accompanying them are their two nameless children, one of whom becomes our narrator for a bit. As they travel, they document, in many ways, that travel, much as each of them has documented for much of their lives. The archive that is carried with them and accumulated anew as they journey gives the reader insight into both relationships and, I guess I could say, current events that are both heartbreaking and ignored, filled with peril and terror. I would like to say that there is a nicely wrapped ending which ties up the loose ends, but just as in life and in our difficult present, it's not as easy as that. And though we may feel somewhat adrift from time to time, and even at its conclusion, we're informed, enlightened, and guided to a new understanding of a tragedy that unfolds each day in a country that once stood for freedom, asylum, and welcome. So with that, welcome, Valeria, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
First, I have to ask you, because, you know, since you started writing this book in 2014, long before that idiot was elected, so much has happened. How has that affected you and your work since things were a mess back then? And how has it affected your perception of what's going on now? What you wrote was a portent and a kind of prescient vision of the situation today. So much has happened since you wrote the book or started it.
Yeah, unfortunately, both Lost Children Archive and my previous book, Tell Me How It Ends, became more timely as time went by. I started writing Lost Children Archive in 2014 during a road trip from Manhattan to Arizona. I started taking notes for it, and then I stopped writing it at some point because I became more deeply involved with the refugee crisis involving unaccompanied children arriving in the U.S. seeking asylum and protection. I became involved as a translator in court first, and then in the Hempstead community in Long Island, and just in different ways. And I had to stop writing the novel because I was using it as a kind of vehicle for my political frustration and rage, and also as a vehicle for sort of informing about the deeper historical roots of this crisis. Deeper historical roots, I mean, back to American interventionist politics in the 70s in Central America. And I was, of course, like writing a terrible novel, right? Trying to stuff all this in. So I stopped writing it and wrote Tell Me How It Ends, which is a very straightforward kind of X-ray view of both the American immigration system and the reasons why children are in an exodus, basically, from Central America across Mexico and sometimes into the U.S., sometimes they stay in Mexico. And that was in 2014 into 2015. But as, of course, as brutal as the Obama administration was with this particular population of immigrants and refugees, of course, the Trump administration has just taken it to another level. I feel kind of like the Obama administration paved the way for this disaster by applying certain policies, such as creating a priority docket for the children's cases, which would deport them more rapidly. But I don't think anyone during the Obama administration, just civilians and politicians, imagined that we were going to get to where we are now, and just in terms of the barbarism and the cold, cruel institutional violence. So, of course, a lot of what I wrote in that period has become kind of resignified by reality, right? And even just the term Lost Children Archive, which was an early title I was working with, is now it's kind of like eerie, because although I was thinking back then of lost children more as sort of children who've lost their right to childhood because of the very difficult circumstances in which they grow up and have to journey across nations and arrive undocumented and seek asylum. More than anything, I was thinking of childhood as being lost, right? And now, of course, lost children seem to refer to children who have been separated from their families and are kind of, and so many of them are lost. I mean, their families don't know where they are, and they are lost in some kind of dark bureaucratic hole, possibly in a detention center somewhere in the U.S., and they're not accounted for. And so, I mean, I think that's what happened, though, with happens with language, right? I mean, words get resignified over time, reused, and it's something that one is never in control of, and that's a good thing, I think. I mean, that's also the power and the potency and the beauty of language, how it can, how it becomes resignified.
Why do you think, and you do because it's the title, why do you think an archivist and an archive or a documentarian, or what the husband is, a documentarianist, is that right? The right word?
Yes.
So what service do you perform a lot of services, but what service does the archival and the documentation, what does that do for us?
I think that, the husband is a documentarist and the wife is a documentarian, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like just a wordplay that the boy, their son, uses to say that he's more like a chemist and she's more like a librarian. And I'll leave that interpretation to people, right? I mean, I think that discussing documentation is also sort of discussing the way we look at the world, and we choose to map it out, right? Like what we choose to include and we choose to exclude in documentation process is already an aesthetic, but also a political stance, right? Mapping in and mapping out parts of the world. So
right.
I mean, I think a lot about that and what it implies in the context of storytelling, like what you tell, what you choose to leave out, what you edit out, how you focus something, and that, I mean, that is a meditation that's in the core of the novel, which is ultimately a meditation about the politics of storytelling, or the politics of documenting / storytelling, right? Like, what do we make visible and what remains invisible? How do we position ourselves in front of that?
And it's funny, you don't just document, but in the boxes, in the trunk, there's so many literary references, some of which are familiar, some of which were totally alien to me. And then at the end, you very carefully acknowledge what you borrowed in a certain sense. And I wonder why you chose to create such a vast kind of archive of literary references that the reader could then take advantage of.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot.
The way you're phrasing this brought this to mind. I met this amazing scientist not that long ago when I was writing the novel. His name is Martin Chalfie, and he won the Nobel Prize, I think, maybe a decade ago or maybe more, for something really astonishing. He discovered that cells are a difficult space to investigate because they are dark spaces, and you have to taint them in order to sort of see outlines of membranes and things like that. But that also just changes some of their structure. And so he was able, with another scientist whose name unfortunately I'm forgetting, isolate the whatever it is in bioluminescent, I'm not sure if that's the right word, bacteria that makes them shine. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
There's something called bioluminescence, and it's bacteria that light up when they're in contact with movement or air. Anyway, so he isolated that particle and placed it inside a cell. And the way he described it to me was kind of like just lighting up a light inside the dark space of a cell that then becomes this kind of visible library, right?
That's so cool.
This space like full of things that you can read and interpret and understand just by this, like moving in this tiny light inside the space of the cell. And I mean, I bring that image into the conversation, not only because I find it beautiful and mysterious, but I feel that like a book can also be sort of a place where you move around a little bit in the dark sometimes. It's an entire universe. It's a place where people live, where people die, where people divorce, where people go to the bathroom, where they have sex, but it's also a world that is constructed from all these particles of experience, and that experience often comes, and in my case definitely so, from other books and other words and other minds. So I feel that like bringing in that the boxes with archive and references was a little bit like allowing the readers to like bring in some light and seeing what the library inside that world.
Yeah, it's like,
right? It's like taking them into the cells of the book and allowing them to see what composes it.
It's funny because I have an independent bookstore, and what I always like is when in the used book section or the rare book section, especially when someone is looking for a particular book, and they climb my book ladder, and they find the book, but they also see the book on either side of the book they're looking for, and that book might change their life.
Totally.
And
And
it's happened to me, and I love when that happens. And the funny thing, when you're interviewed, which I really like, is when people ask you questions like, well, so how does the disintegration of the marriage inform the immigration difficulties? And you go, and you go, yeah, you go, what? It doesn't. It has nothing to do with it. And I love when you do that because you approach your definition of the novel. And I thought about this before we started. And your definition of the novel is an interesting one, and it's kind of murky from time to time, but it's also a really nice way of describing what a novel is supposed to do. Mm. And, you know...
Yeah, I guess you're asking about the definition of the novel, but, I mean, I do think that... I think that, I wouldn't like to define the novel, but, like... The way I envisage my work is always like particular approaches to life or to problems that I am concerned with. And every novel for me is an instrument that helps me approach those questions, those subjects, those intuitions, those pains. And then I shape my novels according to what I like how I want to explore those issues, right? So, I mean, I don't know, just to give an example and not remain so super theoretical. With the story of my teeth, I was interested in investigating the relationship between like workers in a juice factory and that in a juice factory that funded a huge art collection, and also like the problem of like value of things in the chain of in the kind of chain of command, right? From people making juice in a factory to objects in an art gallery, and sort of how value gets added on to things, and what role like money plays in that. And it was a whole knot of problems around value that I wanted to explore. So what I did was I wrote a novel in installments for the workers of the juice factory that they read weekly and then commented and then provide feedback and criticize brutally, etc. And it was in that conversation that I was able, and the structure of that novel is very much like a chapbook 19th century weird intervention of many voices, and it's like kind of something that grew collectively. And so, but that novel has nothing to do in shape and spirit, maybe, than as compared to Lost Children Archive, which is like a deep dive into I guess meditations around storytelling and around end of the world kind of feelings, and the feeling that the world is somehow changed beyond our recognition, and we're still trying to come to terms with it and with how to approach it and document it and register it and archive it and not feel it so alien. So what I'm, yeah. I mean, all this to say that each novel for me is like a different machine to, machine is perhaps not the best image, but a different animal, a different instrument to deal with a particular problem.
Yeah, and
in that sense, all my novels are similar, right? Because they respond they're an engagement with reality more than like an abstraction of it or a mimicry of it or just simple storytelling. I'm not interested in that kind of fiction.
And it's funny, you know, at the bookstore. Well, first of all, everyone says you can't judge a book by its cover, but everybody does judge a book by its cover when they come into my bookstore. And that's why publishers are very careful about covers. But intelligent readers, like if you take, for example, and I don't want to do any spoilers, but when the two children do what they do in the middle of the book and they decide to take action and do something that's out of the blue, I think the motivation behind what they do is kind of it's very nebulous of why they do what they do. And I think, you know, the idea of reading this intelligently and insightfully and closely, I mean, I think it really enhances what the reader begins to understand. And and some people just gloss over it and say, oh, they did this. But then the idea is, why does the boy decide to do this?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is also that motivation is something that I discussed a lot with early readers of this the book and the manuscript. And, you know, I mean, one other issue that maybe we can talk about more, because we started this way and it won't be a spoiler, but like this marriage in the novel is falling apart. And some early readers would ask me, like, okay, but why? Yeah. What happened? Why is it falling apart? And I'm very adverse to having to psychologize and explain every... I mean, life is not like that either, right? I mean, why did the marriage fall apart? Yeah, well, it's such an array of reasons. And we are accustomed to storytelling in such a way that A follows, or B follows A, and that leads directly to C and to D and whatever, the sort of linear explanation of, rather than like the very ramified, murky, chaotic way in which motivations and outcomes in our lives actually play out.
Yeah, I mean, I practiced law for 30 some years, and I did divorces until I could afford not to do them anymore. And there were so many times where someone, the wife or the husband, would say, you know, my spouse is such a jackass, but they would use different language. And I said, I would say, were they like that when you married them? And if they were, why did you marry them? And you do a good description of how head over heels they were at the outset. And it really does describe that feeling. And then, you know, many times people just can't, you ask them why, and they just don't know why. And it's not the cliche-ish of drifting apart or anything, or losing the passion. Sometimes it's just what happens. And what struck me, and what we've already kind of gone over a little bit, is that it doesn't necessarily have to be point A to point B. Their relationship doesn't necessarily have to deal with children on top of trains. you know, it doesn't have
to. There's no attempt to draw any kind of parallel between family separation and separation of a marriage. That would be, like, not only, like, ignorant, but just not sensible at all or sensitive in any way. There's a word that maybe relates to things, which is separation. But I mean, that's about as far as the relationship between these two aspects of the novel goes.
And the other question that you're asked all the time, but I'll ask it again, is, well, part of it is because you live this way in a certain sense, is why did you choose the sonic medium, the medium of sound, rather than another one of our senses to convey the measure of this work?
Well, there's several reasons. One of them has to do with kind of early on. I pay a lot of attention to my process and method. It takes me, part of my writing process, and a long part of it, meaning it's something that I spend sometimes years in, is discovering the exact method and process for the particular book I want to write. And when I say that, I mean, for example, will taking photos, Polaroid photos, or any other format, in my process of documenting things, help me in trying to understand the way to tell the story, or will sound recording help me? And with this novel, at some point, I began recording sound a lot, although I had begun actually taking photos of a road trip with my family. I ended up recording more than anything, and recording is also just a way of listening, right? Just as photographing is a more attentive way of seeing. It puts you in that mental space. And in that process, I started reading about sound recording, also to understand, like, different approaches that I could have to recording. And I came across the work of the acoustomologist Stephen Feld, who I talk about in the novel, actually. Well, he created the field of acoustomology, which is a kind of hybrid of sound studies and epistemology, right? So his fundamental question is how we understand space through sound. How do we acquire knowledge through listening, right, as opposed to other senses? And his body of work very much influenced the way I thought about sound, and also how I wrote. I started thinking about knowledge in terms of the process of listening. And then at another level, perhaps less, I mean, not a more trivial level, but a more obvious level, I also just think that sound, as opposed to image, forces us to slow down. I mean, if we listen to a recording, we sit with it in time. There's no kind of instant consumption of sound piece, right? As opposed to an image that has this kind of ephemeral and also immediate and instant quality. And I was very much interested in exploring, like, our relationship to time in this novel. How we now deal with this sort of avalanche feeling of time just passing over us somehow, and what storytelling can do to slow us down, or listening and recording can do in helping us slow down.
And once again, it is all archival, and you seem to take, I don't know. I was going to say obsessive, but that's not the right word. It's just the interest in, my brother does the same thing. My brother has taken like 500,000 pictures in his life, 10,000 of which are airplane wings, which I don't know why he does that.
He's a collector. I need to meet him.
But, you know, whenever you ask him, can you find a picture of Dad when he was like 16? He turns around and he just finds it. And he's like the archivist of our family and of our company. And there is something so valuable about that. And it reminds me of the Polaroids during the book that the boy takes, and also the Polaroids that you show at the end of the book. And then in the beginning of the book, I kind of got angry at you a little bit because I kept thinking, why is everyone nameless? Why doesn't she just give them names? And then as I read further and further, it became much more clear to me why you did that. But since everyone's asked you and it's out there in the reviews and all that, why don't you explain a little? Because I've heard you explain it before, why that was a process that, you know, it's very unusual for a novel, but why that was something you decided was important.
I've never had a chance to ask the people that ask me this question over and over, why this is such an, like a concern.
Well, it's something you said. You said something about you don't like characters to be full blown, you know, like out, you know, like Athena.
Yeah.
Right.
Totally.
Yeah, you said that,
but
and I understand that completely.
It's so disconcerting when a character doesn't have a name. I wonder, like, what is it that this? I mean, it's a curiosity, it doesn't seem to me that it's, you know, like, I don't know. I think it's also, well, I'll let you answer, and then I'll say.
Well, yeah, and what I was thinking was, you know, readers like to imagine in their mind, it's like if it's cinematic, I wonder who would play this person in the movie. And it's really hard when they don't have a name for you to attach an image. And then
you've just given me a really good, like, tool to answer this question in the future, too. Because, you know, one of the things that I'm very conscious about when I write is, like not imagining cinematically, right?
Right.
And I think that our imagination has been so, like, colonized by TV and cinema, like representation on screen of life, that it's hard for us to imagine if not in that kind of texture, right? And in that, not only texture, but also in that kind of narrative framework, right? How things are supposed to be arranged in a particular order to somehow resemble life, or will be believable or relatable or whatever category we choose. So, I mean, I think that, I mean, I'm interested at least in a kind of literature that takes us, I don't know, that forces our imagination to maybe, I don't want to say decolonize itself, it sounds a bit pretentious, but kind of go beyond the normal ways we usually imagine. And not only that, there's I guess also like a more political side to it, which is that giving a name and describe, I mean, these characters don't only not have like names, but you don't know what color their eyes are, or you know that they're, that the little girl's eyes swell up and like get all red around the edges when she's about to cry, but you don't know what color they are. So there's these particularities in the descriptions, but not these generalities that immediately place them in a pigeonhole.
No, except for the fact that from the very beginning, you know that they're both almost precociously intelligent and articulate for their ages.
Right, but that doesn't place them in any kind of cultural, suffocating space out of which they cannot then exit because they've been framed in a particular way.
Well, and because they're so intelligent, they don't understand the way in which their parents act, because the way in which their parents act at many times is illogical, especially for the partially painted father. And, you know, people in the reviews have gone, oh, you know, why doesn't she make the father more visible, more, give him more characteristics.
And, well, partly because husbands and fathers have talked enough, you know. and I don't know, in the literature that I grew up reading and then also writing, like it's always the male gaze on women, and it's an effort that's worth doing to try to reconfigure the way that we see.
Yeah, I know. It's true. Like, if you're reading Gabriel Garcia Marquez, you're exactly right. But then if you're reading Water for Chocolate, it's kind of the opposite, too. So.
Yeah, but that's still a super, super, like, I don't know. It's the way women are viewed. It's almost like voyeuristically. Like, we look into their intimacy, there's a way of gazing that I think that, I mean, in the Latin American tradition, for sure, that a lot of us, I mean, and I think that I was like that in my first books, we looked at ourselves from a male gaze, just because that's how we were trained to read and write.
Yeah, and the thing about that is because you don't look at it voyeuristically, and again, trying to keep away from spoilers, when you do that litany of autopsy reports, you know, Americans read, that's what they think. They read about one 10-year-old girl, and I'm guilty of the same thing. And then you feel, oh, how horrible that is. But then you stop, and then you go to do your next thing. You don't act upon it, whereas you do. But it's hard. Well, that's the question is, and I meant to ask you this before, is do you feel like things are going to get better? Are you fatalistic about this situation? Do you feel like...
No. I mean, I have no idea if things are going to get better. Politically, I think it's good also not to know. I think more than in terms of optimism and pessimism, I think about my work and just my relationship to my work in activism as well, in terms of creating agency through what I do, because the world is always going to have problems, but I think it's about how we self-educate and equip ourselves to face problems sensibly and with intelligence and with clarity of mind.
Why did you decide, one, to make Lord of the Rings by William Golding such an important part of the book, and why did you also decide, almost in a mystical fashion, that every time they try to play it, the first line of Cormac McCarthy's The Road comes up?
Well, those are secrets. Why did I decide those things? It's books that resonate in different ways with the story that I'm telling.
Yeah, but...
And whose echoes... either emotional echoes, more in the case of the McCarthy, The Road, or echoes, sort of more philosophical echoes in the case of Lord of the Flies, would produce sort of against the board, you know, the sort of the resonance board of the novel. Right? So it's, I mean, a lot of books are in conversation in this novel, as you noted earlier, and those echoes for me, because of the problems they talk about, were very present.
When I first read Lord of the Flies when I was a kid, and the boy essentially reads it, and the mother gives commentary on it. You know, this is what happens when civilization breaks down. And so it's hard not, that part of the book, it's hard not to analogize that with what is happening. So then the next question is, are rules, you know, civilization is like, it's like creme brulee. It has, you know, this top part that's kind of burnt and hard, but if you tap it with a spoon, underneath it's all soft and gushy. And it's like civilization is just that top layer.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take much to go below that. And that's what the mother kind of says. So thank you so much, Valeria, for being here. It's a wonderful book. It'll be on the front table at our bookstore, and no doubt it would be a book club selection, and people will be arguing back and forth over the table about issues in the book, including the...
I'm very glad to know. I hope so. I hope that's true.
And then if you're ever...
I think a book has to be refutable, create conversation rather than drown in a sort of...
Yeah,
only single opinion, right?
Yeah, I don't want to have Gone Girl or Girl on a Train. So in any event, thanks so much for being here, and thanks for being
Thank
so candid
you so
about
much.
Your book. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
So we were talking with Valeria Luiselli about her latest novel, Lost Children Archive. It's, in some ways, it's a difficult novel. In some ways, it's different than most novels you'll read. It's informed by current events, but it was written before the current occupant of the White House was elected. And it's really kind of prescient and important of what a portent of what came after 2014. So I can't say I enjoyed it. It's like I really learned a lot from it. And it's one of those novels that when the book club reads it, there's going to be a lot of people that think one way and a lot of people think another way about it. But it's one of those books that you should definitely read because it helps you understand what's going on in the world today. So, and you know, some of the books coming up are the same kind of books. So if you continue to join us... This woman, Chris Kander, she wrote this new novel called The Weight of a Piano, which does the same thing. You know, the piano is kind of the protagonist, and it moves around from place to place. And as it does, it changes the lives of those people who come in contact with it. And then Whitney Sharer will discuss, they're all women, her captivating debut novel, which is The Age of Light, and has gotten a lot of press and is a really cool book. You'll enjoy that interview. So join us. And as always, for a complete schedule, you can always just go to wellingtonsquarebooks.com. We have it there. Or you can simply download the podcast at Podomatic, but it's much easier to download them at iTunes. And if you have the iTunes podcast app, then they just once you subscribe, they just keep showing up. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, as always. And we look forward to having you here next week on another edition of The Avid Reader.